the piece is titled Trump Dealt Blow as Republican-led Arizona Audit Reaffirms Biden Win. The article has been published by the Reuters news agency. A review of results by Donald Trump's allies in the Republican Party has reaffirmed he lost the 2020 presidential election to Joe Biden in Arizona's most populous county, capping a widely panned effort spurred by Trump's false claims over voter fraud. Arizona Senate President Karen Fan, the Republican who paved the way for the so-called full forensic audit of 2.1 million ballots in Maricopa County, Arizona, said the review's overall vote tally matched the initial results in November. At a Senate hearing on the review, which found only small variations yielding 99 additional votes for Joe Biden and 261 fewer votes for Donald Trump, Karen Fan said, "Truth is truth, numbers are numbers. Those numbers were close, within a few hundred." The conclusion will dismay Donald Trump's supporters who had pushed for the review, many in the expectation that it would prove his unfounded assertions that he was robbed of re-election due to orchestrated fraud. So far, no such proof has been produced either by Donald Trump or his backers. Outside groups tied to the Stop the Steal movement and other efforts to cast doubt on the 2020 election results raised nearly all of the $6 million to fund the inquiry, viewing it as a catalyst for similar investigations in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and other battleground states that Donald Trump lost. Texas, meanwhile, on Thursday, 23rd of September, the Secretary of State's office said the state had begun an audit of the presidential election in its four largest counties, that is Dallas, Harris, Tarrant, and Collin, an announcement that came hours after Donald Trump publicly called for such a move. Although Trump carried Texas, Joe Biden won three of the targeted counties. Donald Trump, who had predicted the Arizona inquiry would substantiate his claims, issued a statement that appeared at odds with the review's findings, calling it a big win for democracy and a big win for us. Ben Ginsburg, a longtime Republican election lawyer who represented Republican George W. Bush when he prevailed over Democrat Al Gore in a 2000 electoral dispute, called the review's conclusions a huge defeat for former U.S. President Donald Trump. Ben Ginsburg said on a media call organized by the state's United Democracy Center and nonpartisan policy group, he said, "This was Donald Trump's best chance to prove his case of elections being rigged and fraudulent, and they failed." In Arizona, Joe Biden won by just over 10,000 votes, a narrow win confirmed by a hand recount and multiple post-election tests for accuracy. Joe Biden carried Maricopa County, which includes Phoenix, by about 45,000 votes, making it critical to his defeat of Donald Trump. The Arizona inquiry is part of a larger effort by Republicans to undermine faith in the 2020 presidential election and gain more control over the voting process. So far this year, at least 18 Republican-led states have passed legislation curbing ballot access, moves they claim are needed to ensure election integrity. Democrats say such laws are aimed at gaming the system, since Republicans tend to do better in low-turnout elections. Karen Fan said the state Senate was working on legislation to achieve an unimpeachable electoral process, based on alleged issues found in the review. She Secretary called for improvements to the signature verification process for absentee ballots, to the maintenance of voter rolls, and to cybersecurity, even though no evidence has emerged that the state systems were breached. Democratic leaders, meanwhile, said they were worried Republicans would use the review as a pretext to enact laws suppressing the vote. Arizona's top elected official, Katie Hobbs, a Democrat, in a statement denounced the review as a political stunt that created massive security risks, cost millions of dollars, and has shaken faith in free and fair elections. A wide array of election experts, Democrats, and some Republican officials had long rejected the Arizona audit as a highly partisan boondoggle run by contractors without relevant expertise. The lead contractor was an obscure company, Cyber Ninjas, whose chief executive has promoted conspiracy theories about orchestrated fraud in the election. The audit was marked by practices that critics described as ranging from inappropriate to bizarre, including counters marking ballots with blue ink, which can alter how they are read by machines, and workers checking for traces of bamboo fibers, based on a conspiracy theory that forged ballots may have been shipped in from Asia. While finding the overall vote tallies largely matched up, the report highlighted a series of alleged problems, including 10,342 potential voters who voted in different counties, which Cyber Ninjas termed a critical finding. As part of a point-by-point rebuttal on Twitter, Maricopa County called that claim laughable, suggesting those conducting the review may have failed to account for people with matching names and birth years in different counties, a not uncommon occurrence in a state of more than 7 million people. Karen Fan said she had passed along the review's findings to Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich, who said his election integrity unit would look at the evidence. Mark Brnovich said Arizonans deserve to have their votes accurately counted and protected. Uniform of a soldier. Part 2.
On the last day of the summer of 1980, on September the 22nd at 10 a.m., a report was received from Gilanetar, a provincial city located in the western border of Iran, about the bombing of Iranian territory by the regime of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. In the very early hours of the attack, it was not clear what had happened and what the exact scope of the attack was. At 1:30 p.m., reports of bombing reached Tehran from the western province of Ilam and the city of Dehlorom. 15 minutes later, Ahvaz reported the airport had been bombed. 5 minutes after Ahvaz, at 1:50 p.m., Kermanshah reported a similar attack. 5 minutes later, at exactly 1:55 p.m., Bushehr also reported that it had been bombed. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the Despul Air Force Base was also bombed. There was panic and chaos in the corridors of the Air Force. Everyone was wondering what was going on. Eyewitnesses had seen olive-colored MiGs flying in the Iranian airspace and dropping bombs. Twenty minutes had passed since the bombing of the Despul Air Force Base when the same olive-colored MiGs all appeared in the sky of Tehran.
Oh,
black smoke rose from Mehrabad Airport. At that very moment, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei was waiting to talk to the factory workers at the General Factory near Mehrabad Airport. At that moment, Ayatollah Khamenei decided not to cancel his speech for the factory workers. He calmly went behind the podium and gave them heart. Until then, Ayatollah Khamenei was dressed as a cleric, the clothes he wore since he was a teenager. But he did not know that fate had prepared another garment for him as well. This is the story of the presence of the leader of the Islamic Revolution during the early years of the imposed war on Iran, a depiction of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Husseini Khamenei in military uniform.
It was another small victory for the activists who are fully backed by their country's supreme ruler, the Ayatollah Khomeini.
At this opportunity, the greatest change came after the revolution.
The next move is evidently up to the United States.
With the Muslim student followers of Imam's Line Plan, the espionage headquarters of Iran's biggest enemy was captured. The interim government resigned after capturing the American embassy, referred to as the Den of Spies. In the months after the IRGC was established, the interim government did not play an effective role in assisting the IRGC. Now, the Revolutionary Council, in order to improve the quality of the IRGC, handed over the leadership of the IRGC to Ayatollah Khamenei on November the 24th, 1979. In the meantime, Ayatollah Khamenei called on the commander of the Western Corps, Mohammad Borujerdi, to create a connection with the Kurdish people in order to confront the separatist counter-revolutionary groups in Kurdistan. The relations and connection that preceded the establishment of the Muslim Kurdish Peshmerga. The Peshmerga were made up of Kurdish people who fought for the ideals of the Islamic Revolution against these separatist counter-revolutionary groups. On November the 26th, the Imam issued a decree to establish the Organization for Mobilization of the Oppressed, or the Basij Organization. In early 1980, almost a year after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the first presidential elections were held. Abul Hassan Bani Sadr was elected. He openly opposed the approach of the Islamic Republic Party, of which Ayatollah Khamenei was one of the founders. Ayatollah Khamenei resigned from his military post on the 24th of February, 1980. The Persian New Year in 1980 began with increased threats of aggression by the Ba'athist regime of Iraq. But at the same time, the Carter administration in the U.S. was threatening the Islamic Republic after severing ties with Iran. In an interview with Pars News Agency on April the 9th of 1980, Ayatollah Khamenei considered this coincidence as a sign of Saddam's dependence on the U.S. But at that point, no one knew how close this analysis was to reality. The first indication of the correctness of this analysis came on the morning of the 25th of April, 1980. Early that day, Mohammad Muntazir Qaim, commander of the Yazd IRGC, heard suspicious reports about an area in Tabas Desert. So he went to the area to investigate. In the middle of Tabas Desert, the U.S. military equipment and a number of corpses that belonged to American soldiers were found. It soon became known that the United States had plotted to attack Tehran the previous night to free the American spies. But a sandstorm had ruined their plans. The reports about the Tabas incident worried and concerned the Imam. And what made matters even more suspicious was that after the Americans fled, some commanders decided to bomb American equipment left behind in Tabas. In this bombing, Mohammad Muntazir Qaim, commander of the Yazd IRGC, was martyred. On May the 19th of 1980, the Imam appointed Ayatollah Khamenei and Dr. Mustafa Chamron as his representatives in the Supreme National Defense Council, which was the highest decision-making body in the country's military affairs and was chaired by President Bani Sadr himself. In this new ruling, the Imam had instructed Ayatollah Khamenei to report to him on the state of the army every week. That is why Ayatollah Khamenei set up the military advisory office. In Tehran, everything seemed calm. On the night of July the 9th of 1980, however, the presence of a stranger at Ayatollah Khamenei's house disturbed that peace. An Air Force pilot came to Ayatollah Khamenei's door with important news. An infiltration network inside the army led from abroad by Shapur Bakhtiar, the Shah's last prime minister, had plotted a major coup. The IRGC forces were able to obtain clues about the infiltration, but its dimensions were still unclear. What had become evident was that they were planning to bomb the Imam's residence in Jamoran and conduct a coup. Other major centers, such as the Islamic Consultative Assembly, the Presidency Office, and the main headquarters of the Army and the IRGC, had also been targeted by the coup plotters. Ayatollah Khamenei conveyed the matter to other officials in the country, including the Imam himself. In a quick operation, the coup network was identified and the coup leaders and members were arrested. The confessions revealed that the coup meetings had started right after Ayatollah Khamenei left the army. In the summer of that year, the Iraqi border attacks by Saddam became very evident. The warning arrows were now approaching their main target. The shadow of war was so close that everyone could feel it. However, the president paid no attention to issues regarding the defense of the country. He did not even hold meetings of the Supreme Defense Council, even while Iraq's border encroachments on Iran were on the rise. The total number of Saddam border encroachments recorded at the UN is 636. Just a few days before the start of Saddam's large-scale invasion of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei used the Friday prayer sermon to send a message of confidence and morale to the armed forces. In addition to this influential scene, Ayatollah Khamenei also witnessed the oppression of the country's military personnel, and soldiers who were the target of the MKO and Marxist guerrillas' intense propaganda. On September the 22nd of 1980, Ayatollah Khamenei had returned to the General Factory where he had spent the moment of the victory of the revolution. Little did he know that this time his presence would be tied to yet another monumental moment in Iranian history. He waited in a room for the workers to gather in the lecture hall, but suddenly the doors and the walls began to shake. On that day, Ayatollah Khamenei personally saw the fighter jets attacking Tehran's international airport. Saddam's regime, with the support of Western countries, had dared to attack revolutionary Iran, a nationwide attack that was now the beginning of a new chapter for the military service of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Husseini Khamenei.
On September the 22nd of 1980, the day the Ba'athist regime invaded Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei was at the General Factory. There, he decided to go to the Army's Joint Chiefs of Staff headquarters. They were waiting for him there. But this time, not in the usual buildings, he was taken to the war room. Everyone was in the war room. At that moment, it was reported that 10 or 12 other airports in the country had been bombed. The meeting was filled with commotion. Ayatollah Khamenei asked the then commander of the Air Force, Colonel Fakhouri, why they had not taken any defensive action. Enemy planes should not have been allowed to come to Tehran without being intercepted. Fakhouri had no answer. At that moment, all the commanders were worried. Ayatollah Khamenei suggested that if the military commanders were so worried, the people must be even more concerned, and the first task of this council should be to give morale to the people. Everyone welcomed the idea. They unanimously asked Ayatollah Khamenei to write a message in his own pen
and to read the message to the Iranian people on the radio in his own voice. This voice reached the people's homes in those moments of fear and distress. That same night, Imam Khomeini's first message was broadcast on the Islamic Republic of Iran radio and television. The fact was that, as ordered by the Imam, the Air Force was preparing for a tough response to Saddam's regime. On September the 23rd of 1980, about 140 Iranian fighter jets under the command of Colonel Fakhouri bombed enemy targets. Ayatollah Khamenei received the report of the operation, and as a member of parliament, he immediately went to the parliament building to convey the news to the people's representatives in a speech before his order. But the deputy chief of staff of the army, Brigadier General Fallahi, as well as commander of the Air Force, Colonel Fakhouri, also had some bad news. Ayatollah Khamenei was told that the air operation could continue for a maximum of 30 more days, after which all Iranian planes would gradually become non-operational one by one. Reports from Fakhouri said that all of these planes, which were maintained by American technicians prior to the revolution, will quickly become non-operational in the course of the war, and that spare parts could not be purchased due to U.S. hostility. Ayatollah Khamenei was supposed to convey this news to Imam Khomeini. The Imam, however, was very calm in the face of this news and announced that there would be no problems and that the Air Force would be able to continue flying after these 30 days. The confidence of the Imam boosted Ayatollah Khamenei's morale. At this critical juncture, UN Secretary General Kurt Waldheim is calling for a ceasefire on both sides of the conflict. Chairman of the UN Security Council, Tayyip Salim, on behalf of the members of the council, wants both sides to end the war. Secretary General of the Islamic Conference, Habib Chatti, also called for immediate ceasefire. None of them acknowledge the fact that Iran has been invaded by Saddam's regime and is defending itself, while the Ba'athist army is invading and has occupied Iran's territory. In the first 5 days of the war, 20,000 kilometers of the country's territory was occupied by the enemy. During the sermons of the Friday prayers of the September the 26th, Ayatollah Khamenei announced that the United States was the director behind the scene in the war. Although Ayatollah Khamenei was the Friday prayer leader of Tehran, the representative of the people of Tehran in the parliament, the representative of the Imam in the Supreme Defense Council, and the head of the Imam's advisory office in the army, he was very eager to be present on the war front. Finally, September the 27th arrived. At 9 o'clock in the morning, Bani Sadr came to Imam Khomeini to give the worst possible news. The maximum resistance of the army against the enemy was only 1 week, he predicted, and after that, there was no more ammunition. He presented the report within only 15 minutes and then hurried away from the Imam under the pretext of welcoming the President of Pakistan, who was scheduled to arrive in Tehran at 4:30 p.m. At 10:30, the rest of the country's officials and commanders gathered with the Imam. On that day, the Imam announced that surrender was simply not an option and that the defense would continue as long as Iranian territory was in the hands of the enemy. The Imam said that even if the enemy enters the cities of Iran, people will continue to resist. This was Imam's explicit opinion about the war, which provided a good opportunity to fulfill Ayatollah Khamenei's wish, that is, joining the front. He went to see the Imam and asked for his permission. Seeing this scene, Dr. Chamran also decided to accompany Ayatollah Khamenei. Outside the Imam's house, Ayatollah Khamenei suggested to Chamran that they go to the front together. Dr. Chamran asked for a few hours. They decided to meet each other at Tehran's Mehrabad airport. During this time, Ayatollah Khamenei returned home. He wanted to go to the battlefield in the next few hours, where it could be a point of no return. Some of the bodyguards insisted on going with him. Ayatollah Khamenei agreed on the condition that when they got there, they would abandon his protection and join the war. He went to Mehrabad with the guards. Chamran had also arrived. There was a group of about 50 people, all volunteers for guerrilla and irregular warfare. Their plane took off in the afternoon and flew to Ahvaz. In the evening of that day, they landed in complete darkness on the runway of Ahvaz Airport and then went to the place where the headquarters of the city's armored division was located. The commanders did not have good news. It was clear that the enemy was only 12 kilometers away from reaching the city of Ahvaz, the heart of Khuzestan province. If Ahvaz fell, Khuzestan would be lost. The situation of the defense forces in Ahvaz was disappointing, and they were not ready for any operation. The first task that Ayatollah Khamenei felt was necessary at that moment was to organize the Ahvaz defense forces. A decision had to be made. Dr. Chamran had also decided to go and identify the enemy. The guerrilla forces that came with Dr. Chamran were getting prepared. It was at that moment that Ayatollah Khamenei decided to go toward the enemy tanks with Chamran. It was in the last hours of the night of September the 27th, 1980, that Ayatollah Khamenei went to the front line with Chamran's forces. In the darkness of the night, they advanced a little and then had to walk. After a short walk, they reached a point where the sound of a tank could be heard. It turned out that they were only 500 meters away from the enemy's base. Chamran, who identified the area, ordered the troops to return. It was early in the morning when they reached the barracks of the 92nd Division in Ahvaz. The military personnel were both surprised and happy to see Ayatollah Khamenei in military uniform. In the morning of the same day, that is September the 28th of 1980, some military commanders came to Ayatollah Khamenei with an offer. If Iran dumped water in the plains of the western region of Ahvaz, the movement of the enemy's tanks would be impossible. Ayatollah Khamenei agreed, and preparations were made for an artificial flood against enemy tanks. But there were other issues as well. Ayatollah Khamenei and Chamran set up the irregular warfare headquarters. Popular forces and nomads from all over the country registered in his headquarters to go to the front and defend the country. But regulating the work of this headquarters required the selection, training, and the adoption of security measures. Under the supervision of Ayatollah Khamenei, Colonel Salimi was put in charge of the headquarters. The command of the forces was also given to Dr. Chamran. On the 29th of September, bad news arrived. The enemy was approaching Ahvaz from Hamidiye. Hamidiye was located 23 kilometers from Ahvaz, and the enemy was only 5 kilometers from Ahvaz on the 29th of September, nearing the city from Hamidiye Road. There was no time to hesitate. The Imam had sent a message. Are the young people of Ahvaz dead? This message increased the presence of the people to defend the city. On September the 30th, the head of the Khuzestan Water and Electricity Organization reviewed and approved the plan to release water in the south of Hamidiye. The plan was immediately implemented under Ayatollah Khamenei's command at the irregular warfare headquarters. The plains of the area were suddenly flooded. The water subsided after a while, but the enemy tanks were stuck. As night fell, a group of 40 IRGC members prepared for an operation that was to take place that night. Ali Qayyur was in charge of the operation. He was trained as an Air Force Special Force in Germany and Italy. He joined the IRGC when the revolution took place and took over the military training of the Revolutionary Guards.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
Senate Republicans on Monday, 27th of September, blocked a spending bill needed to avert a government shutdown this week and a federal debt default next month, moving the nation closer to the brink of fiscal crisis as they refused to allow Democrats to lift the limit on federal borrowing. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Emily Cochrane and Katie Edmondson. The piece is titled, Republicans Block Government Funding, Refusing to Lift Debt Limit. Senate Republicans on Monday, 27th of September, blocked a spending bill needed to avert a government shutdown this week and a federal debt default next month, moving the nation closer to the brink of fiscal crisis as they refused to allow Democrats to lift the limit on federal borrowing. With a Thursday, 30th of September deadline looming to fund the government and the country moving closer to a catastrophic debt limit breach, the stalemate in the Senate reflected a bid by Republicans to undercut President Biden and top Democrats at a critical moment, as they labor to keep the government running and enact an ambitious domestic agenda. Republicans, who had voted to raise the debt cap by trillions when their party controlled Washington, argued on Monday that Democrats must shoulder the entire political burden for doing so now, given that they control the White House and both houses of Congress. Their position was calculated to portray Democrats as ineffectual and overreaching at a time when they're already toiling to iron out deep party divisions over a $3.5 trillion social safety net and climate change bill, and to pave the way for a bipartisan $1 trillion infrastructure measure whose fate is linked to it. The package that was blocked on Monday, which also included emergency aid to support the resettlement of Afghan refugees and disaster recovery, would keep all government agencies funded through to 3rd of December and increase the debt ceiling through the end of 2022. But after the bill cleared the House a week earlier with just Democratic votes, it fell far short of the 60 votes needed to move forward in the Senate on Monday. The vote was 48-50 to advance the measure. Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, the majority leader, was among those voting no, a procedural maneuver to allow the bill to be reconsidered at some point. But there were no immediate details about next steps. The resulting cloud of fiscal uncertainty marked yet another challenge for President Biden and Democratic leaders, are facing a daunting set of tasks as they press to keep the government funded. Scrounge together the votes for the infrastructure bill, also slated for a vote on Thursday, 30th of September, and resolve their disputes over the broader budget plan. They must also hatch a new strategy for raising the statutory limit on federal borrowing, which officials have said is on track to be reached as early as mid to late October. "It may not be by the end of the week. I hope it's by the end of the week," President Biden said on Monday at the White House, referring to the outlook for accomplishing all of the imperatives Congress now faces. Ticking off the four pieces of legislation, he added, "We do that, the country is going to be in a great shape." Without any of them, President Biden's agenda and his party's fortunes would be in peril, a prospect that Republicans appear to relish. Although both political parties willingly racked up trillions of dollars in debt in recent years, Senate Republicans presented their refusal to vote for the debt cap increase on Monday as deserved comeuppance for Democrats, who are pushing past GOP opposition to muscle their multi-trillion dollar domestic spending and tax increase plan through Congress. "We will not provide Republican votes for raising the debt limit," said Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the minority leader in the Senate, repeating a warning he has issued for months. Mitch McConnell added, "Bipartisanship is not a light switch that Democrats get to flip on when they need to borrow money and switch off when they want to spend money." The debt ceiling increase is needed to finance borrowing that occurred in the past under administrations of both parties, not to pay for plans that President Biden has yet to sign into law. And so far, there is little outreach or negotiation to resolve the impasse. Still, Senator Mitch McConnell sought to frame the vote as a test of Democrats' competence, as he and other Republicans vowed to support a nearly identical temporary spending package without an increase in the debt ceiling. "We'll see if Washington Democrats actually want to govern," Senator McConnell said. Democrats rejected that alternative, accusing Republicans of recklessly jeopardizing the country's full faith and credit. Senator Chuck Schumer said the vote meant the Republican Party has now become the party of default, the party that says America doesn't pay its debts. "That isn't your typical Washington fracas," he said, adding, "It's one of the most reckless, one of the most irresponsible votes I have seen taken place in the Senate." Even as the spending measure fell short, Democratic leaders worked to unite their caucus behind the bipartisan infrastructure bill. Moderate Democrats have agitated for a vote this week on that legislation, while liberal Democrats have warned they will oppose it without action first on the $3.5 trillion social policy and economic package. "The two bills are linked," said Representative Ilhan Omar, Democrat of Minnesota and a progressive, "and they have to be linked in order for anything to pass the House." Amid the looming deadline, Speaker Nancy Pelosi of California spoke with Senator Chuck Schumer and President Joe Biden on Monday, according to a White House summary. Later, Nancy Pelosi huddled privately with Democrats to try to break through the impasse in Congress, signaling that the House would move forward with the $1 trillion infrastructure bill before the social policy package was fully negotiated. "It isn't about diminishing the importance of the reconciliation," Nancy Pelosi told members of her caucus, according to a person who disclosed the remarks on condition of anonymity. She went on to say that lawmakers could not insist on waiting to vote on the bipartisan infrastructure bill as negotiations continued with the Senate over the reconciliation package. Yet, as of Monday evening, it was still unclear how congressional leaders would handle the urgent legislation to keep the government running. White House officials and Democratic congressional leaders have ramped up a drumbeat of warnings in recent weeks about the economic toll of delaying a vote on the debt ceiling.
simple question.
The news that Australia, the USA, and the UK are combining forces to build a fleet of nuclear submarines in response to a perceived threat from China has surprised the world. Yet, no country seems to have been more surprised than France, whose embassy in Britain is here behind me in central London, and who, until recently, believed they were in line to build a dozen submarines in a high-value contract.
I'm delighted to join.
In retaliation for the lost contract, France has now recalled its ambassadors from America and Australia. Meanwhile, in the escalating tensions, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison revealed he didn't think France could effectively deliver the right submarines, adding this decision was based on the question of whether France would provide the vessels required to do the job, concluding, our strategic judgment, based on the best possible of intelligence and defence advice, was that it would not. As the storm over this future Pacific nuclear submarine fleet grows into a major international crisis, the potential impact could last for years, with anger and divisions exposed for all to see. Thus, the one nation unaffected by the Western attempt to contain Beijing's sphere of influence is, ironically, China.
How reasonable is it for the French government to express such public outrage after losing this high-value contract? And what impression of Western unity does it give when Paris recalls its ambassadors from Australia and the United States? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. The USA, the UK and Australia are planning to build a fleet of nuclear-powered submarines to try and contain the influence of China. How smart is this plan? That's what we put to the public here in London. This is what they told us.
I think it's not going to be healthy. Contractors are going to be a winner. I think it's going to be a thing where politics will always be politics. Someone's always going to always complain. I think China's a rising power, so therefore it's all these other countries are feeling threatened anyway. But it's never going to be good. I mean, if one of those by chance explodes, that's a natural disaster in itself, and obviously a loss of life. I guess it's not really healthy. And I think, like I said, control's an illusion.
Gosh, that's really tricky. I think that we have to be careful because China's power is increasing, and we don't want to be in a position where nobody can contain them. I think the world is the most peaceful when we all have enough power that no one person is a superpower, as it were. So I think it makes common sense.
Yeah, that's probably not the smartest move, in my opinion. No. No, I think that there's better ways to approach that problem than that.
I don't really agree with any nuclear sort of power at all, because I think we should all be friendly to one another, and I just don't agree with that at all.
Well, my understanding is that they already had some sort of agreement with France anyway, so I can understand that France wants to protect their own interests. That's only natural.
Well, you make certain suppositions when you say it's in order to control China and they've pushed France out. You know, I don't know the details. I mean, we know the bits that we've read in the paper. We know there's been a change in that contract. We know that France is very upset. But, you know, there's a lot more behind these complicated multi-billion dollar contracts and transactions. There's geopolitics, and I really don't know, you know, the issues. I don't agree that change in the contract is going to control China. I mean, that's a pretty bold statement, so I can't agree with that statement.
I think people need to get a lot of inside peace within themselves for this not to happen in a way where it's going to be all about war, which not really necessary, but that's the problem. It's a communication problem, and it's all driven by ego.
I think that it seems like it's just coming under the whole, like,
policy rhetoric that America is back with Biden. What do I think about it? I mean, what I'd like to see is us move, obviously, towards a world against U.S. hegemony and towards more of a multipolar world that grants agency to the global south and in the context of China. Listen, I don't condone a lot of what China's done, but these things are very, very nuanced. And what I'd like to see is a more multipolar world rather than a hegemonic world, if that's possible, within a nation-state system. But that's what I'd like to see. So
I think it's a very interesting stance to take. However, this sort of idea of fire with fire has been something that has been done for, 40 years almost. So just changing it instantly like that to go straight to peace is something that probably isn't something that can happen overnight. It'll take time. And in the meantime, if this is what they think is the safest thing, then we've got to leave it to them, because I'm not one to speak too much about it, to be honest.
The French government is very angry because it thought it was going to build 12 submarines and now it won't. How does the public here in London feel about the French authorities describing the Australian government as liars?
Yeah, I think maybe it's more subtle approach again, and not just everyone try and just maintain some calm strategies to this situation.
I mean, it just sets a precedent for the future. I mean, this is not how people should behave. This should not be our focus. We've got way bigger things to worry about. For example, what's going on in the world now with the coronavirus and all of these conspiracies, and we really need to be careful with what we listen to and what we take into our minds, really. But yeah, no, too much money is being spent on weapons. Could go to a better place.
All politicians, every country, no offence to you, but they don't either conceal the truth, but it's like, I'm sure we can find liars here. I'm sure France can find liars in their political system. So it's, it can be a case of pot and kettle in that regard. So in that regard, French politicians calling other countries' politicians liars is, it's a bit daft,
I mean, our Prime Minister is a liar, so I completely agree with the French Prime Minister.
I don't know what happened exactly between the two, but they had a deal and they didn't respect the deal, so...
I think that's France the type, would be my immediate thought around that. But to answer your question, no, I don't think it's reasonable, but it's not a surprise.
It's politics at the end of the day, isn't it? They just want to be who they want to be, and I think there's a lot more to it, and I don't think you need to get into anyone else's business, personally.
I'm not convinced that the French are in the strongest moral place to call people liars, because I think if you look back on their history, they may have muddied the truth once or twice. I'm sorry that they're upset, and I hope that they can find some resolution, but I don't think name-calling is helpful.
France has recalled its ambassadors from America and Australia. What message does this send China when it sees Western allies fighting over this 37 billion euro submarine contract?
Yeah, they had France had to react anyway, so...
Look, I just think it's irritating. I think China work the way China work, and we need to prevent irritation. I'd be looking at other ways to cooperate with them and work with them.
I think it shows them that the remaining countries in that alliance are pretty determined, and if France wants to take its toys and go home, so be it.
I think it just shows that we're children and we just don't get what we want. We've, in the past, we've colonialised everywhere, and now people are telling us what to do or not what to do, and we don't like it. So I just think people are just throwing a hissy.
I don't know. It's one of those things where I think China's probably just taking advantage of that, and, but then again, if the shoe was on the other foot, wouldn't they, if France, be taking advantage of it? It's just that I think they're complaining because they lost contracts, and it's a financial issue rather than a lying issue,
I think it points to maybe how naive the West is in this context. What does China think? I mean, China was the next global superpower, albeit if there is a multipolar level of governance at the international scale, but China is the I don't think they care. I think they know that, you know, I guess it plays into their hands. You know, if they want to offer, like, let's say, in development assistance in sub-Saharan Africa, they can just be like, well, look at, you know, the West and the international bodies and look at them quarrel among themselves. And I think, yeah, I mean, obviously that it's something that plays into China's hands, but at the same time, yeah, I wouldn't know what else to say. Yeah.
This whole political nonsense is something that I don't necessarily, like, get really deep into, in all honesty. However, outing nations for their decisions isn't something that necessarily should be done, in my opinion.
We're not really squabbling. They've agreed to go into a pact with US, the UK and Australia. I mean, it's just the French are sore losers, as is generally the case.
Let's look at the facts. The initial aim had been to build 12 conventionally powered submarines in France. These were estimated with a value of 37 billion. The new plan is to build at least 8 nuclear-powered submarines with the USA, UK and Australia, excluding France from the project. Currently, it is estimated that America has approximately 68 submarines, the United Kingdom has 11 and Australia has 6. However, China, the country that the Western powers are so concerned about, already has around 79 and could easily build more if it wants to.
How does the public feel about claims that building more nuclear submarines makes the world safer? Or do they fear that this is the beginning of a new underwater arms race with China?
No, the person who's got their finger on the button will make it more stable. It's a deterrent, and that's all it should be used for.
I do. I think deterrency is a valid way to try and contain global superpowers and one nation completely overpowering the rest of the world. So, yeah, I do think so.
The whole nuclear debate is a tough one, isn't it? I can see both sides, but I don't want buttons to be pressed. I much prefer other ways to find areas to common ground to communicate on and build relationships rather than that, yeah.
No, I disagree. Building nuclear subs is more peaceful because at the end of the day, if that deterrent isn't there, you don't need to use it. So why build it and spend loads of money that taxpayers are paying, you know?
Well, they've been a deterrent up until now. When you're talking about submarines, I guess you're talking about a nuclear deterrent rather than submarines themselves. So they've proved to be very efficient up until now. Whether we need to continue to have them depends upon the leaders that we've got. I think most people believe in diplomacy is the best way to solve a situation. But if you always have that one option that's available to you, so the so-called nuclear option, then it does make certain countries think twice, I think, before they do certain things. So, yeah, I think probably on balance, and I know that it's a very nuanced argument, but I think on balance it's probably a good thing.
No, absolutely not. I personally worked as a commercial diver on nuclear submarines, fixing ships, fixing the panels and the metalworks and welding it all back together. And that stuff is super, super dangerous and shouldn't be allowed anywhere. Yeah, it's petrifying weaponry. So that shouldn't, you know, nuclear warfare is absolutely not the way to create peace. No, definitely not.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, what's peaceful for one person needs to be peaceful for the whole of humanity. So if we feel like creating nuclear weapons for our country is going to create peace, well, it's you know, it's displacing a whole lot of other people at the same time. So no.
Nuclear power has never been good for that, has it? I mean, it just seems like it's a false argument. So therefore, I don't think it makes the world safer. I mean, the only people complaining about are those who already have nuclear power. And yet they're complaining that other countries have it.
No, of course, you know, the less nuclear submarines, the better. I think in the context of like a underground arms race, or what you were saying, underwater arms race, I think that there might be a bit too much emphasis on like tangible arms races and stuff when a lot of, you know, a lot of competition is digital now with, you know, cybersecurity and stuff like that. What do I think of it? Obviously, I think that our analysis needs to be updated for 2021 post-COVID. We need to incorporate cybersecurity into our analysis a bit more. But at the same time, yeah, obviously, you know, I don't agree that that makes the world a safer place. But again, everything is nuanced.
Yeah, I disagree. However, I don't think I'm in a position to necessarily speak on the matter in any sort of academic backing on either part, in all honesty. So, yeah.
Using a nuclear submarine, if it can promote peace, then that's amazing. But they're not designed for that. They are a war machine. They're designed for one purpose and one purpose only. You can use war machines to promote peace, but it's all dependent on how they're used. So.
Clearly, that isn't going to be a productive answer, and people are going to feel frightened and worried and stressed out with that kind of approach. And it's quite an angry attitude. Talking, maybe, trying to unite with talking and compromise and working together than building more nuclear weapons might be a better approach.
Looking to the future, China already has a dozen nuclear-powered submarines of its own, and almost 80 submarines in total. So what will China do if these nuclear submarines are built by the West? Here's what the public thinks.
Well, they will fight against that and retaliate and build more to feel safer, which is not the best approach, but you can see why they would react like that. It's common sense, isn't it?
One plus one equals. I mean, that's what they're going to do. Just keep building out their force, aren't they? That's I think that's their strategy. They're not alone in that, but I think that's what we're going to see. Just a race to increase arms.
Very interesting to see. I don't know. I mean, China's governed by some very clever people. I think they also want to go down the route of diplomacy where possible, but at the same time. If you've got particularly the US, I think, sort of trying to raise some sort of dominance in the region, that's going to cause some sort of conflict. But what you tend to have in these sort of times is periods of tension and then a period of reflection and then tends to be a period of sort of going back to the status quo.
I think they'll just build more. it'll just become a contest. And I can't ever imagine all of these submarines and war weapons being used. What would be left of the world if we all had to just start creating more and more submarines and more weapons and bombs? And then will we ever use them? And if we do, what's going to come of that? We'll just be destroying land, homes, people, like whole societies will be destroyed. It just doesn't make sense.
At the moment, I don't know. I know it's all very tense, but they just need to grow up a bit and actually start talking. Communication is key. And if they can come to an arrangement, they can come to a deal, then that's the best thing for everybody. So.
Well, I believe in disarmament. I believe in demilitarization, personally. But you have to get all parties to agree to that. So there's agreements with Russia on missiles, there's agreements with China, and unless both parties or all parties who are involved in geopolitics and who have large militaries agree to de-escalation, a one-sided agreement is not an agreement to do anything. So unfortunately, sometimes you have to say, well, I'd really rather demilitarize, reduce our weapons, but if you're not willing to do that, if you're choosing to build islands in the China Sea, and if you're increasing your military and your weaponry, then you're forcing us to do it. That's not